built up, reversed itself. Columbia canceled the release of the record and dropped 50 from his contract. There was too much violence associated with him. It was bad for business. A few inquiries made it clear that other labels felt the same. He was being blackballed from the industry. One executive told him flatly he would have to wait at least 2 years before he could think of resurrecting his career. The assassination attempt was the result of an old drug beef from his days as a dealer. The killers could not afford to let him survive and would try to finish the job. 50 had to keep a low profile. At the same time, he had no money and could not return to street hustling. Even many of his friends, who had hoped to be a part of his success as a rapper, started to avoid him. In just a few short weeks, he had gone from being poised for fame and fortune to hitting the bottom. And there seemed no way to move out of the corner he found himself in. Could this be the end of all his efforts? It would have been better to die that day than to feel this powerlessness. But as he lay in bed at his grandparents' house, recovering from his wounds, he listened a lot to the radio, and what he heard gave him an incredible rush of optimism. An idea started taking shape in his mind that the shooting was in fact a great blessing in disguise, that he had narrowly survived for a reason. The music on the radio was also packaged and produced. Even the tough stuff, the gangster rap, was fake. The lyrics did not reflect anything from the streets that he knew. The attempt to pass it off as real and urban angered him to a point he could not endure. This was not the time for him to be afraid and depressed, or to sit around and wait a few years while all of the violence around him died down. He had never been a fake studio gangster, and now he had the 9 bullet wounds to prove it. This was the moment to convert all of his anger and dark emotions into a powerful campaign that would shake the very foundations of hip-hop. As a hustler on the streets, 50 had learned a fundamental lesson. Access to money and resources is severely limited in the hood. A hustler must transform every little event and every trifling object into some gimmick for making money. Even the worst shit that happens to you can be converted into gold if you are clever enough. All of the negative factors now facing him, little money, no connections, the price on his head, could be turned into their opposites, advantages and opportunities. That is how he would confront the seemingly insurmountable obstacles now in his path. He decided to disappear for a few months and hold up in various friends' houses. He began to recreate himself and his music career. With no executives to have to please or worry about, he could push his lyrics and the hard sounds as far as he wanted. His voice had changed as a result of the pieces of bullet still lodged in his tongue. It now had a hiss. It was still painful for him to move his mouth, so he had to rap more slowly. Instead of trying to normalize and retrain his voice, he determined to turn it into a virtue. His new style of rapping would be more deliberate and menacing. That hiss would remind listeners of the bullet that had gone through his jaw. He would play all of that up. In the summer of 2001, just as people had begun to forget about him, 50 suddenly released his first song to the streets. It was called Fuck You, the title and the lyrics summarizing how he felt about his killers and everyone who wanted him to go away. Just putting out the song was message enough. He was defying his assassins openly and publicly. 50 was back, and to shut him up, they would have to finish the job. The palpable anger in his voice and the hard-driving sound of the song made it a sensation on the streets. It also came with an added punch. Because he seemed to be inviting more violence, the public had to grab up everything he produced before he was killed. The life and death angle made for a compelling spectacle. Now the song started to pour out of him. He fed off all the anger he felt and the doubts people had had about him. He was also consumed with a sense of urgency. This was his last chance to make it, and so he worked night and day. 50s mixtapes began to hit the street at a furious pace. Soon he realized the greatest advantage he possessed in this campaign, the feeling that he had already hit bottom and had nothing to lose. He could attack the record industry and poke fun at its timidity. He could pirate the most popular songs on the radio and put his own lyrics over them to create wicked parodies. He didn't care about the consequences. And the further he took this, the more his audiences responded. They loved the transgressive edge to it. It was like a crusade against all the fake crap on the radio. And to listen to 50 was to participate in the cause. On and on he went, transforming every conceivable negative into a positive. To compensate for the lack of money to distribute his mixtapes far and wide, he decided to encourage bootleggers to pirate his tracks and spread his music around like a virus. With the price still on his head, he could not give concerts or do any kind of public promotion, but somehow he turned even this into a marketing device. Hearing his music everywhere, but not being able to see him, only added to the mystique and the attention people paid to him. Rumors and word of mouth helped form a kind of 50 mythology. He made himself even scarcer to feed this process. The momentum now was devastating. You could not go far in New York without hearing his music blasted from some corner. Soon, one of his mixtapes reached the ears of Eminem, who decided this was the future of hip-hop, and quickly signed 50 in early 2003 to his and Dr. Dre's label, Shady Aftermath, completing one of the most rapid and remarkable turnarounds in fortune in modern times. The Fearless Approach. The following is a quote from 50 Cent. "Every negative is a positive. The bad things that happen to me, I somehow make them good. That means you can't do anything to hurt me." Events in life are not negative or positive. They are completely neutral. The universe does not care about your fate. It is indifferent to the violence that may hit you or to death itself. Things merely happen to you. It is your mind that chooses to interpret them as negative or positive. And because you have layers of fear that dwell deep within you, your natural tendency is to interpret temporary obstacles in your path as something larger, setbacks and crises. In such a frame of mind, you exaggerate the dangers. If someone attacks and harms you in some way, you focus on the money or position you have lost in the battle, the negative publicity, or the harsh emotions that have been churned up. This causes you to grow cautious, to retreat, hoping to spare yourself more of these negative things. It is a time, you tell yourself, to lay low and wait for things to get better. You need calmness and security. What you do not realize is that you are inadvertently making the situation worse. Your rival only gets stronger as you sit back. The negative publicity becomes firmly associated with you. Being conservative turns into a habit that carries over into less difficult moments. It becomes harder and harder to move to the offensive. In essence, you have chosen to cast life's inevitable twists of fortune as hardships, giving them a weight and endurance they do not deserve. What you need to do, as 50 discovered, is take the opposite approach. Instead of becoming discouraged and depressed by any kind of downturn, you must see this as a wake-up call, a challenge that you will transform into an opportunity for power. Your energy levels rise. You move to the attack, surprising your enemies with boldness. You care less what people think about you, and this paradoxically causes them to admire you. The negative publicity is turned around. You do not wait for things to get better. You seize this chance to prove yourself, Mentally framing a negative event as a blessing in disguise makes it easier for you to move forward. It is a kind of mental alchemy, transforming shit into sugar. Understand, we live in a society of relative prosperity, but in many ways, this turns out to be a detriment to our spirit. We come to feel that we naturally deserve good things, that we have certain privileges due to us. When setbacks occur, it is almost a personal affront or punishment. How could this have happened? We ask. We either blame other people or we blame ourselves. In both cases, we lose valuable time and become unnecessarily emotional. In places like the hood, or in any kind of materially impoverished environment, the response to hardship is much different. There, bad things happening assume a kind of normality. They are part of daily life. The hustler thinks, I must make the most of what I have, even the bad stuff, because things are not going to get better on their own. It is foolish to wait. Tomorrow may bring even worse shit. If 50 had waited, as he had been counseled, he would be just another rapper who had had a moment of success and then faded quickly away. The hood would have consumed him. This hustler mindset is more realistic and effective. The truth is that life is by nature harsh and competitive. No matter how much money or resources you have accumulated, someone will try to take them from you, or unexpected changes in the world will push you backward. These are not adverse circumstances, but merely life as it is. You have no time to lose to fear and depression, and you do not have the luxury of waiting. All of the most powerful people in history demonstrate in one way or another this fearless attitude towards adversity. Look at George Washington. He was a wealthy landowner, but his attitude towards life had been forged by years fighting for the British in the French and Indian War amid the harsh environment of frontier America. In 1776, Washington was made Supreme Commander of the American Revolutionary Army. At first glance, this position seemed more like a curse. The army was a semi-organized mob. It had no training, was poorly paid and outfitted, and its morale was low. Most of the soldiers did not really believe they could succeed in defeating the all-powerful British. Throughout 1777, British forces pushed this weak American army around from Boston to New York, until by the end of the year, Washington had been forced to retreat to New Jersey. This was the darkest moment in his career and in the war for independence. Washington's army had dwindled to a few thousand men. They had little food and were poorly clothed during one of the bitterest winters in memory. The American Continental Congress, fearing imminent disaster, fled from Philadelphia to Baltimore. Assessing the situation, a cautious leader would have chosen to wait out the winter, muster more troops, and hope for some change in fortune. But Washington had a different mindset. As he perceived it, his army would be considered by the British as too weak to pose any threat. Being small, his army could move without the enemy's knowledge and launch an attack that was all the more surprising for coming out of nowhere. Moving to the attack would excite the troops and gain some much-needed positive publicity. Thinking in this manner, he decided to lead a raid on an enemy garrison in Trenton, which proved to be a great success. He followed this up with an attack on British supplies at Princeton. These daring victories captivated the American public. Confidence had been restored in Washington as a leader and the American army as a legitimate force. From then on, Washington waged a guerrilla-style war, wearing out the British with the great distances they had to cover. Everything was turned around. Lack of funds and experience led to a more creative way of fighting. The smallness of his forces allowed him to torment the enemy with fluid maneuvering over rough terrain. At no point Did he decide to wait for more troops or more money or better circumstances? He went continually on the attack with what he had. It was a campaign of supreme fearlessness in which all negatives were converted into advantages. This is a common occurrence in history. Almost all great military and political triumphs are preceded by some kind of crisis. That is because a substantial victory can only come out of a moment of danger, an attack. Without these moments, leaders are never challenged, never get to prove themselves. If the path is too smooth, they grow arrogant and make a fatal mistake. The fearless types require some kind of adversity against which they can measure themselves. The tenseness of such dark moments brings out their creativity and urgency, making them rise to the occasion and turn the tide of fortune from defeat to a great victory. You must adopt an attitude that is the opposite to how most people think and operate. When things are going well, that is precisely when you must be concerned and vigilant. You know it will not last, and you will not be caught unprepared. When things are going badly, that is when you are most encouraged and fearless. Finally, you have material for a powerful reversal, a chance to prove yourself. It is only out of danger and difficulty that you can rise at all. By simply embracing the moment as something positive and necessary, you have already converted it into gold. Keys to Fearlessness. The following is a quote from Friedrich Nietzsche. In nooks all over the earth sit men who are waiting, scarcely knowing in what way they are waiting, much less that they are waiting in vain. Occasionally the call that awakens, that accident which gives the permission to act, comes too late, when the best youth and strength for action has already been used up by sitting still. And many have found to their horror, when they leaped up, that their limbs had gone to sleep, and their spirit had become too heavy. It is too late, they said to themselves, having lost their faith in themselves, and henceforth forever useless. Our minds possess powers we have not even begun to tap into. These powers come from a mix of heightened concentration, energy, and ingenuity in the face of obstacles. Each of us has the capacity to develop these powers, but first we have to be aware of their existence. This is difficult, however, in a culture that emphasizes material means, technology, money, connections, as the answer to everything. We place unnecessary limits on what the mind can accomplish, and that becomes our reality. Look at our concept of opportunity, and you will see this in its clearest light. According to conventional wisdom, an opportunity is something that exists out there in the world. If it comes our way, and we seize it, it brings us money and power. This could be a particular job, the perfect fit for us. It could be a chance to create or join a new venture. It could be meeting the appropriate person. In any event, it depends on being at the right place at the right time and having the proper skills to take advantage of this propitious moment. We generally believe there are only a few such golden chances in life, and most of us are waiting for them to cross our path. This concept is extremely limited in scope. It makes us dependent on outside forces. It stems from a fearful, passive attitude towards life that is counterproductive. It constrains our minds to a small circle of possibility. The truth is that for the human mind, everything that crosses its path can be a potential tool for power and expansion. Many of us have had the following experience. We find ourselves in an urgent, difficult situation. Perhaps we have to get something done in an impossibly short amount of time, or someone we had counted on for help does not come through, or we are in a foreign land and must suddenly fend for ourselves. In these situations, necessity crowds in on us. We have to get work done and figure out problems quickly, or we suffer immediate consequences. What usually happens is that our minds snap to attention. We find the necessary energy because we have to. We pay attention to details that normally elude us, because they might spell the difference between success and failure, life and death. We are surprised at how inventive we become. It is at such moments that we get a glimpse of that potential mental power within us that generally lies untapped. If only we could have such a spirit and attitude in everyday life. This attitude is what we shall call opportunism. True opportunists do not require urgent, stressful circumstances to become alert and inventive. They operate this way on a daily basis. They channel their aggressive energy into hunting down possibilities for expansion in the most banal and insignificant events. Everything is an instrument in their hands. And with this enlarged notion of opportunity, they create more of it in their lives and gain great power. Perhaps the greatest opportunist in history is Napoleon Bonaparte. Nothing escaped his attention. He focused with supreme intensity on all of the details, finding ways to transform even the most trivial aspects of warfare, how to march and carry supplies, how to organize troops into divisions, into tools of power. He ruthlessly exploited the slightest mistake of his opponents. He was the master at turning the worst moments in battle into material for a devastating counterattack. All of this came out of Napoleon's determination to see everything around him as an opportunity. By looking for these opportunities, he found them. This became a mental skill that he refined to an art. This power is open to each and every one of us if we put into practice the following four principles of the art. Make the most of what you have. In 1704, a Scottish sailor named Alexander Selkirk found himself marooned on a deserted island some 400 miles off the coast of Chile. All he had with him was a rifle, some gunpowder, a knife, and some carpenter's tools. In exploring the interior, he saw nothing but a bunch of goats, cats, rats, and some unfamiliar animals that made strange noises at night. It was a shelterless environment. He decided to keep to the shoreline, slept in a cave, found enough to eat by catching fish, and slowly gave way to a deep depression. He knew he would run out of gunpowder, his knife would get rusty, and his clothes would rot on his back. He could not survive on just fish. He did not have enough supplies to get by, and the loneliness was crushing. If only he had brought over more materials from his ship. Then suddenly the shoreline was invaded by sea lions. It was their mating season. Now he was forced to move inland. There he could not simply harpoon fish and sit in a cave brooding. He quickly discovered that this dark forest contained everything he needed. He built a series of huts out of the native woods. He cultivated various fruit trees. He taught himself to hunt the goats. He domesticated dozens of feral cats. They protected him against the rats and provided him much-needed companionship. He took apart his useless rifle and fashioned tools out of it. Recalling what he learned from his father, who had been a shoemaker, he made his own clothes out of animal hides. It was as if he had suddenly come to life, and his depression disappeared. He was finally rescued from the island, but the experience completely altered his way of thinking. Years later, he would recall his time there as the happiest in his life. Most of us are like Selkirk when he first found himself stranded. We look at our material resources and wish we had more. But a different possibility exists for us as well. the realization that more resources are not necessarily coming from the outside, and that we must use what we already have to better effect. What we have in hand could be research material for a particular book, or people who work within our organization. If we look for more information, outside people to help us, it won't necessarily lead to anything better. In fact, the waiting and the dependence makes us less creative. When we go to work with what is there, we find new ways to employ this material. We solve problems, develop skills we can use again and again, and build up our confidence. If we become wealthy and dependent on money and technology, our minds atrophy, and that wealth will not last. Turn all obstacles into openings. The great boxer Joe Louis encountered a tremendous obstacle in the racism of the 1930s. Jack Johnson had preceded Louis as the most famous black boxer of his time. Johnson was supremely skilled, and he beat his white opponents with ease. But he was an emotional fighter. Encountering hostile crowds that chanted "Kill the nigger" only made him more heated and angry. He found himself in constant trouble and quickly burned out from all the hatred. Louis was equally talented, but as he perceived it, he could not gloat or show emotion in the ring. That would incite the white audiences and feed into the stereotype of the out-of-control black boxer. And yet a fighter thrives off his emotions, his fighting spirit, and uses this to overwhelm his opponent. Instead of rebelling against this state of affairs or giving up, Louis decided to use it to his advantage. He would show no emotions in the ring. After knocking someone out, he would calmly return to his corner. Opponents and the audience would try to bait him into an emotional response, but he resisted. All of his spirit and anger went into forging this cold and intimidating mask. The racists could not rail against this. He became known as the embalmer, and it was enough to see his grim expression when you entered the ring to feel your legs getting weak. In essence, Louis turned this obstacle into his greatest strength. An opportunist in life sees all hindrances as instruments for power. The reason is simple. Negative energy that comes at you in some form is energy that can be turned around to defeat an opponent and lift you up. When there is no such energy, there is nothing to react or push against. It is harder to motivate yourself. Enemies that hit you have opened themselves up to a counterattack in which you control the timing and the dynamic. If bad publicity comes your way, think of it as a form of negative attention that you can easily reframe for your purposes. You can seem contrite or rebellious, whatever will stir up your base. If you ignore it, you look guilty. If you fight it, you seem defensive. If you go with it and channel it in your direction, you have turned it into an opportunity for positive attention. In general, obstacles force your mind to focus and find ways around them. They heighten your mental powers and should be welcomed. Look for turning points. Opportunities exist in any field of tension, heated competition, anxiety, chaotic situations. Something important is going on, and if you are able to determine the underlying cause, you can create for yourself a powerful opportunity. Look for any sudden successes or failures in the business world that people find hard to explain. These are often indications of shifts going on under the surface. Perhaps someone has inadvertently hit upon a new model for doing things, and you must analyze this. Examine the greatest anxieties of those on the inside of any business or industry. Deep changes going on usually register as fear to those who do not know how to deal with them. You can be the first to exploit such changes for positive purposes. keep your eye out for any kind of shifts in tastes or values. People in the media or the establishment will often rail against these changes, seeing them as signs of moral decline and chaos. People fear the new. You can turn this into an opportunity by being the first to give some meaning to this apparent disorder, establishing it as a positive value. You are not looking for fads, but deep-rooted changes in people's tastes. One opportunity you can always bank on is that a younger generation will react against the sacred cows of the older generation. If the older set valued spontaneity and pleasure, you can be sure that the younger set will crave order and orthodoxy. By attacking the values of the older generation before anyone else, you can gain powerful attention. Move before you are ready. Most people wait too long to go into action, generally out of fear. They want more money or better circumstances. You must go the opposite direction and move before you think you are ready. It is as if you are making it a little more difficult for yourself, deliberately creating obstacles in your path. But it is a law of power that your energy will always rise to the appropriate level. When you feel that you must work harder to get to your goal because you are not quite prepared, you are more alert and inventive. This venture has to succeed, and so it will. This has been the way of powerful people from ancient to modern times. When Julius Caesar was faced with the greatest decision of his life, whether to move against Pompey and initiate a civil war or wait for a better moment, he stood at the Rubicon River that separated Gaul from Italy with only the smallest of forces. Although it seemed insanity to his lieutenants, he judged the moment right. He would compensate for the smallness of his troops with their heightened morale and his own strategic wits. He crossed the Rubicon, surprised the enemy, and never looked back. When Barack Obama was contemplating a run for president in 2006, almost everyone advised him to wait his turn. He was too young, too much of an unknown. Hillary Clinton loomed over the scene. He threw away all their conventional wisdom and entered the race. Because everything and everyone was against him, he had to compensate with energy, superior strategy, and organization. He rose to the occasion with a masterful campaign that turned all of its negatives into virtues. His inexperience represented change, etc. Remember, as Napoleon said, the moral is to the physical as 3-1, meaning the motivation and energy levels you or your army bring to the encounter have 3 times as much weight as your physical resources. With energy and high morale, a human can overcome almost any obstacle and create opportunity out of nothing. Reversal of perspective. In modern usage, opportunist is generally a derogatory term that refers to people who will do anything for themselves. They have no core values beyond promoting their own needs. They contribute nothing to society. This, however, is a misreading of the phenomenon and stems from an age-old elitism that wants to see opportunities kept as privileges for a powerful few. Those from the bottom who dare to promote themselves in any way are seen as Machiavellian, while those already on the top who practice the same strategies are merely smart and resourceful. Such judgments are a reflection of fear. Opportunism is in fact a great art that was studied and practiced by many ancient cultures. The greatest ancient Greek hero of them all, Odysseus, was a supreme opportunist. In every dangerous moment in his life, he exploited some weakness his enemies left open to trick them and turn the tables. The Greeks venerated him as one who had mastered life's shifting circumstances. in their value system, rigid, ideological people who cannot adapt, who miss all opportunities, are the ones who deserve our scorn. They inhibit progress. Opportunism comes with a belief system that is eminently positive and powerful, one known to the Stoic philosophers of ancient Rome as amor fati, or love of fate. In this philosophy, every event is seen as fated to occur. When you complain and rail against circumstances, you fall out of balance with the natural state of things. You wish things were different. What you must do instead is accept the fact that all events occur for a reason, and that it is within your capacity to see this reason as positive. Marcus Aurelius compared this to a fire that consumes everything in its path. All circumstances become consumed in your mental heat and converted into opportunities. A man or woman who believes this cannot be hurt by anything or anyone. The following is a quote from Niccolo Machiavelli. Without doubt, princes become great when they overcome difficulties and hurdles put in their path. When fortune wants to advance a new prince, she creates enemies for him, making them launch campaigns against him, so that he is compelled to overcome them and climb higher on the ladder that they have brought him. Therefore, many judge that a wise prince must skillfully fan some enmity whenever the opportunity arises, so that in crushing it, he will increase his standing.
Chapter 4. Keep moving. Calculated momentum. In the present, there is constant change, and so much we cannot control. If you try to micromanage it all, you lose even greater control in the long run. The answer is to let go and move with the chaos that presents itself to you. From within it, you will find endless opportunities that elude most people. Don't give others the chance to pin you down. Keep moving and changing your appearances to fit the environment. If you encounter walls or boundaries, slip around them. Do not let anything disrupt your flow.
The Hustler's Flow. The following is a quote from Miles Davis. The old musicians stay where they are and become like museum pieces under glass, safe, easy to understand, playing that tired old shit over and over again. Bebop was about change, about evolution. It wasn't about standing still and becoming safe. If anybody wants to keep creating, they have to be about change. When Curtis Jackson first started hustling in the late 1980s, it was a chaotic world that he entered. Crack cocaine had hit the streets and turned everything upside down. Now the corner hustler was unleashed. Moving to wherever there was money to be made, this new breed of drug dealer had to contend with hundreds of scheming rivals, the erratic drug addicts, the old-style gang leaders who were trying to muscle their way back into the business, and the police who swarmed over the area. It was like the Wild West out there. Every man for himself, making up his own rules as he went along. Some couldn't stand this. They wanted structure, somebody to tell them when to get up and get to work. They didn't last too long in this new order. Others thrived on all the anarchy and freedom. Curtis was of the latter variety. Then one day everything changed. An old-style gangster nicknamed the Godfather made a play for control over the drug traffic of Southside Queens, and he succeeded. He installed his son Germain in Curtis's neighborhood, and the son quickly laid down the law. The family was there to bring order to the business. Germain would be selling these purple top capsules for a cheap price. It would be one size fits all, his capsules or nothing. Nobody could compete with his prices, and any hustler that tried to defy him would be intimidated into submission. They were now all working for Germain. Curtis found this hard to accept. He did not like any kind of authority. He kept trying to get around Germain's tight grip on the area by selling his own stuff on the sly. But Germain and his team of enforcers kept catching him. Finally, they inflicted a good beating on him, and he decided it would be wise to surrender, for the time being. Germain liked Curtis's independent spirit, and decided to take the youth under his wing, schooling him on what he was up to. He had done some time in prison, and had studied business and economics there. He was going to run the crack cocaine business according to a model inspired by some of the more successful corporations in America. He aimed for control of the local drug business through cheap prices and a complete monopoly on traffic. That was the evolution of all successful enterprises, even the new ones such as Microsoft. He personally hated all the disorder on the streets. It was bad for business and made him uneasy. One day he drove by in his red Ferrari and invited Curtis to come along for a ride. He drove to the nearby Baisley Projects, which were controlled back then by the Pharaohs, a gang that was heavily invested in the crack trade and notorious for its violent ways. Curtis watched, with growing discomfort, as Germain explained to its leaders his plan for the neighborhood. He couldn't have freelancers and gangs operating on the margins of his empire. The Pharaohs would have to fall in line as well, but he'd find a way to make it profitable for them. The man's arrogance was increasing by the day. Perhaps he would follow this visit up with some violent act to show the Pharaohs he meant what he said. But Curtis had a real bad feeling from that afternoon. Over the next few days, he did whatever he could to avoid running into Germain. Sure enough, a week later, Germain was shot in the head and killed in one of the back alleyways of the hood. Everyone knew who did it and why. In the months to come, Curtis thought long and hard about what had happened. A part of him had identified with Germain. He too had great ambitions and wanted to forge some kind of empire within the hood. With all the competition on the streets, this could never be an easy task. It was natural, then, for someone like Germain to decide that the only way to create this empire was through force and the buildup of a monopoly. But such an effort was futile. Even if he had lasted longer, there were too many people operating on the fringes who resented his takeover and would have done whatever they could to sabotage him. The fiends would have grown tired of his one-size-fits-all approach. They liked variety, even if it was only in the color of the capsules. The police would have taken notice of his large operation and tried to break it up. Germain had been living in the past, in ideas cooked up in prison in the 1970s, the grand era of the drug lord. Time had passed him by, and in the ruthless dynamic of the hood, he paid for this with his life. What was needed was a new skill set, a different mentality for handling the chaos, and Curtis would be the hustler to develop these skills to the maximum. For this purpose, he let go of any desire to dominate an area with one large operation. Instead, he started experimenting with four or five hustles at the same time. Inevitably, one of the angles would work and pay for all the others. He made sure he always had options, room to move in case the police pushed in and cut off one of his access routes. He interacted with the fiends, looking for any changes in their tastes and ways he could appeal to them with some new marketing scheme. He let those who worked for him do things on their own time, as long as they produced results. He wanted as little friction as possible. He never stayed tied to one venture, one partner, or one way of doing things for very long. He kept moving. The chaos of the streets was part of his flow, something he learned to exploit by working from within it. Operating this way, he slowly accumulated the kind of hustling empire that could surpass what even Germain had attempted. In 2003, Curtis, now known as 50 Cent, found himself thrust into corporate America, working within Interscope Records and dealing with the growing number of businesses that wanted to ally themselves with him. Coming from the streets, with no formal business background, it was natural for him to feel intimidated in this new environment. But within a few months, he saw things differently. The new skills he had developed in the hood were more than adequate. What he noticed about the business executives he dealt with was rather shocking. They operated by these conventions that seemed to have little to do with the incredible changes going on in the business environment. The record industry, for instance, was being destroyed by digital piracy, but the executives could only think of somehow maintaining their monopoly on ownership and distribution. They were incapable of adapting to the changes. They interacted only with themselves, not with their customer base, so their ideas never evolved. They were living in the past, when all of the business models were simple and control was easy to come by. They had the Germain mentality through and through, and in 50's mind, they would someday suffer a similar fate. 50 would stay true to his street strategies. He would opt for fluid positions and room to move. This meant branching out into ventures that were not at all traditional for a rapper. Vitamin Water, a line of books, an alliance with General Motors and Pontiac. These associations seemed disorderly and random, but it was all tied to his compelling image that he continued to shape. He worked 5 different angles at the same time. If one venture failed, he learned and moved on. The business world was like a laboratory that he would use for constant experimentation and discovery. He would mix and mingle with his employees up and down the line and with his audience, allowing them to alter his ideas. The centerpiece of this flow strategy would be the internet, a chaotic space with endless opportunity for a hustler like himself. Without knowing exactly where it would lead, he began putting together his own website. At first, it was a place to showcase new videos and get feedback from the public. Soon, it began to morph into a social network, bringing together his fans from all over the world. This gave him endless space to market his brand and track the changing moods of his audience. His website would continue to evolve like a living organism. He placed no limits on what it could become. Years later, having moved beyond music into as many varied realms as possible, 50 could look back on all the people he had left far behind, the record executives, fellow rappers, and business leaders who had gone astray amid all the rapid fluctuations in the early part of the century, a whole gallery of Germain types who had no flow. No matter the changes to come, he would continue to thrive in this new Wild West environment, just as he had on the streets. The Fearless Approach. The following is a quote from 50 Cent. 50 Cent is a person I created. Soon it will be time to destroy him and become somebody else. As infants, we were surrounded by many things that were unfamiliar and unpredictable. People acting in ways that did not make sense, events that were hard to figure out. This was the source of great anxiety. We wanted the world around us to be more familiar. What was not so predictable became associated in our minds with darkness and chaos, something to dread. Out of this fear, a desire was born deep inside of us to somehow gain greater control over the people and events that eluded our grasp. The only way we knew how to do this was to grab and hold, to push and pull, exerting our will in as direct a manner as possible to get people to do what we wanted. Over the years, this can become a lifelong pattern of behavior, more subtle as an adult, but infantile at heart. Every individual we come across in life is unique, with his or her own energy, desires, and history. But wanting more control over people, our first impulse is generally to try to push them into conforming to our moods and ideas, into acting in ways that are familiar and comfortable to us. Every circumstance in life is different, but this elicits that old fear of chaos and the unknown. We cannot physically make events more predictable, but we can internally create a feeling of greater control by holding on to certain ideas and beliefs that give us a sense of consistency and order. This hunger for control, common to all of us, is the root of so many problems in life. Staying true to the same ideas and ways of doing things makes it that much harder for us to adapt to the inevitable changes in life. If we try to dominate a situation with some kind of aggressive action, This becomes our only option. We cannot give in or adapt or bide our time. That would mean letting go of our grip, and we fear that. Having such narrow options makes it hard to solve problems. Forcing people to do what we want makes them resentful. Inevitably, they sabotage us or assert themselves against our will. What we find is that our desire to micromanage the world around us comes with a paradoxical effect. The harder we try to control things in our immediate environment, the more likely we are to lose control in the long run. Most people tend to think of these forms of direct control as power itself, something that shows strength, consistency, or character. But in fact, the opposite is the case. They are forms of power that are infantile and weak, stemming from that deep-rooted fear of change and chaos. Before it is too late, you need to convert to a more sophisticated, fearless concept of power, one that emphasizes fluidity. Life has a particular pace and rhythm, an endless stream of changes that can move slowly or quickly. When you try to stop this flow mentally or physically by holding on to things or people, you fall behind. Your actions become awkward because they are not in relation to present circumstances. It is like moving against a current as opposed to using it to propel you forward. The first and most important step is to let go of this need to control in such a direct manner. This means that you no longer see change in chaotic moments in life as something to fear, but rather as a source of excitement and opportunity. In a social situation in which you want the ability to influence people, your first move is to bend to their different energies. You see what they bring, and you adapt to this, then find a way to divert their energy in your direction. You let go of the past way of doing things and adapt your strategies to the ever-flowing present. Often what seems like chaos to us is merely a series of events that are new and hard to figure out. You cannot make sense of this apparent disorder if you are reactive and fearful, trying to make everything conform to patterns that exist only in your mind. By absorbing more of these chaotic moments with an open spirit, you can glimpse a pattern, a reason why they are occurring, and how you can exploit them. As part of this new concept, you are replacing the old stalwart symbols of power, the rock, the oak tree, etc., with that of water, the element that has the greatest potential force in all of nature. Water can adapt to whatever comes its way, moving around or over any obstacle. It wears away rock over time. This form of power does not mean you simply give in to what life brings you and drift. It means that you channel the flow of events in your direction, letting this add to the force of your actions and giving you powerful momentum. In places like the hood, the concept of flow is more developed than elsewhere. In such an environment, obstacles are everywhere. Those who live there cannot move and make a good living beyond the confines of the hood. If they try to control too many things and become aggressive, they tend to make their lives harder and shorter. The violence they initiate only comes back at them with equal force. With so many physical limitations, hustlers have learned to develop mental freedom. They cannot let their minds be bothered by all these hindrances. Their thoughts have to keep moving, creating new ventures, new hustles, new directions in music and clothes. That is why trends change so quickly in the hood, which often serves as the engine for new styles in the culture at large. With people, hustlers have to adapt to all of their differences, wearing the mask that is appropriate for each situation, deflecting people's suspicions. Hustlers are consummate chameleons. If they can maintain this mental and social fluidity, they can feel a degree of freedom beyond all the physical confinements of the hood. You too face a world full of obstacles and limitations. A new environment where the competition is more global, complicated, and intense than ever before. Like the hustler, you must find your freedom through the fluidity of your thoughts and your constant inventiveness. This means having a greater willingness to experiment, trying several ventures without fear of failing here or there. It also means constantly looking to develop new styles, new directions you can take, freeing yourself up from any inertia that comes with age. In a world full of people who are too conventional in their thinking, who respect the past far too much, such flow will inevitably translate into power and more room to move. The fearless types in history all reveal a greater capacity to handle chaos and to use it for their purposes. No greater example of this can be found than Mao Zedong. China in the 1920s was a country on the verge of radical change. The old imperial order that had suffocated China for centuries had finally fallen apart. But fearing the disorder that could be unleashed in such a vast country, the two parties vying for control, the nationalists and the communists, opted to try to contain the situation as best they could. The nationalists offered the old-style imperial order with a new face. The communists decided to impose on China the Lenin model, waging a proletariat revolution centered in urban areas, controlling key cities in the country, and enforcing strict adherence to party dogma among its followers. This had worked well in the Soviet Union, creating order in a short period of time, but it had no relevance to China. By the end of the decade, this strategy was failing miserably. On the verge of annihilation, the communists turned to Mao, who had a totally different concept of what to do. Mao had been raised in a small village among the country's vast peasant population. As part of his upbringing, he was immersed in the ancient belief systems of Taoism, which saw change as the essence of nature and conforming to these changes as the source of all power. In the end, according to Taoism, you are stronger by having a softness that allows you to bend and adapt. Mao was not afraid of the vast size and population of China. The chaos this could represent would simply become part of his strategy. His idea was to enlist the help of the peasantry so that communist soldiers could blend into the countryside like fish in water. He would not attack city centers or try to occupy any single position in the country. Instead, he would move the army around like a vaporous force that would attack and then disappear, the enemy never knowing where it was coming from or what it was up to. This guerrilla force would stay in constant motion, allowing the enemy no breathing space and giving them a sense of chaos. The nationalists epitomized the opposite school of fighting, conventional to the core. When Mao finally unleashed on them his new brand of warfare, they could not adapt. They held on to key positions, while the communists encircled them in the vast spaces of China. The nationalists' control narrowed to the point of a few cities, and soon they crumbled completely in one of the most remarkably swift turnarounds in military history. Understand, it is not only what you do that must have flow, but also how you do things. It is your strategies, your methods of attacking problems, that must constantly be adapted to circumstances. Strategy is the essence of human action, the bridge between an idea and its realization in the world. Too often these strategies become frozen into conventions, as people mindlessly imitate what worked before. By keeping your strategies attuned to the moment, you can be an agent of change, the one who breaks up these dead ways of acting, gaining tremendous power in the process. Most people in life are rigid and predictable. That makes them easy targets. Your fluid, unpredictable strategies will drive them insane. They cannot foresee your next move or figure you out. That is often enough to make them give way or fall apart. Keys to fearlessness. The following is a quote from Sun Tzu. Thus one's victories in battle cannot be repeated. They take their form in response to inexhaustibly changing circumstances. It can be likened to water. As water varies its flow,